8 o'clock. And here is Jack Dennett, brought to you by Imperial Oil.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Friday, the 18th of July, and after a long spell of dry, hot weather, we're starting to know now how the ancient mariner felt, because it seems each day we advise you to get ready for heat, humidity, and weather discomfort. Isolated thunderstorms could possibly develop this afternoon, but it's a bit difficult right now to track them down and let you know where they might land. The possibility of Metro getting a soaking, however, seems very remote. So we're to be simply sunny, hot, and humid today and tomorrow with blistering temperatures this afternoon. Our high for the day should be around 32, and that's pretty close to the 90 mark in Fahrenheit. And in a moment, we'll be back.
Jack Dennett, as we all know, will not be back. That way he had of welcoming you each morning at 8 o'clock with the weather, as if he, Jack Dennett, was bringing it to you personally, will not be heard again. It was the proof of his professionalism and courage that when he delivered that last good morning weather opening on Friday, July 18th, he knew inside that he was dying. The cancer that had been checked by surgery the previous winter was showing signs of renewing its insidious attack. He was to leave that weekend for a vacation in Alberta, Calgary, his old hometown. It was not to be. This will not be about his death. That is not how he would have wanted it. It is not how he told of the passing of the great, the interesting, or the infamous in his newscasts. It was about their lives and the mark they left that he spoke. This, then, is a tribute to and a story about the life of Jack Dennett. It will be told through the voices of his friends and colleagues and the voice of the man himself. First, naturally, are just some of us who worked with him. Wally Crowder, Gordon Sinclair, and Bob Hesketh.
Known Jack ever since I came to CFRB, which was 27 years ago, and at that time Jack was doing the 11 o'clock news at night, and obviously I didn't get much to see much of him, but 25 years ago he took over the 8 o'clock news in the morning, and since then Jack and I have been rather close. There was never a day that we didn't have conversation, and if you've been listening, I guess you already know that we had kind of a running kidding each other for the past few years. I always said he was the Jack Benny of radio, and that he was pretty tight with the buck. And actually, he wasn't. He was a more than generous person, both with himself and with his money. But we had to have something to take a run at each other, and we've had fun all through the years.
Well, Jack Dennett was the very soul of integrity in Canadian radio broadcasting, and thus he can never be really and truly replaced any more than Jim Hunter, whom he replaced himself, was really replaced. Jack was himself. He was full of integrity, and yet he was one of the most modest fellows that I ever personally worked with, and I worked with Jack longer than with anyone else in any other field. But he was a very modest fellow who won wide acclaim coast to coast and never really felt it belonged to him personally.
It's often difficult to say anything that doesn't sound trite and stilted at the time of the passing of a close friend and associate, which Jack Dennett was. I've had the pleasure and advantage of working with Jack for nearly 16 years in the newsroom, and I've admired his integrity and his truthfulness and his loyalty to his audience. At his profession, he was one of the, if not the best in the country, and I'm sure he received many offers from competitors, but his loyalty showed through again. It would have been unthinkable to Jack to even entertain any thought of leaving CFRB. I share with literally hundreds of thousands of his friends who never really met him personally, with those closer to him, a great emptiness at his loss.
Another whose association goes even farther back, retired CFRB station manager Jack Dawson, who worked in the West with Jack.
I was, of course, terribly shocked when I heard the news this morning of Jack's death. He wrote to me his first day back at work on the 3rd of March and told me that he knew of his condition, he was prepared to live with it, he would hope that he was lucky enough to, as he termed, and in his note to me, grab a brass ring and live for many more years. Unfortunately, that was not to be. Jack was one of the kindest people that I've ever known in my life, and I know that the broadcasting business will be infinitely poorer because of his passing.
Another longtime associate is the chairman of Argus Corporation and Standard Broadcasting, J.A. Bud McDougald.
I am grateful to have known Jack Dennett for over 30 years. Not only did I value his true friendship, which will be sadly missed by all of us, but the world has lost one of its finest broadcasters, whose integrity and great talents were second to none.
While the Dennett voice was a part of thousands of Ontario households, it was known across the rest of the country and the United States through sport.
Hockey Night in Canada, brought to you by Imperial Oil and Esso dealers, agents, and distributors.
The only other man with a longer history in hockey broadcasting is, of course, Foster Hewitt.
Jack was a great friend of mine over the years. I recall him, the first time I met him was in 1934. And we were on a barnstorming trip with the Toronto Maple Leaf Hockey Club. And he was in Calgary at that time. And I had him as a color man for me. That's the first introduction to sport that I recall. And I had him in 34, and again when we went back in 36. And of course, he did a tremendous job and a wonderful person. And so I was anxious to get him to come east. And I talked to him for quite some time about it, and he was a little dubious of leaving the West. But he finally, after about 6 or 8 months, called me when he got to Toronto, and he decided to make the move, and then he ended up at CFRB, and he's been there ever since.
From the man who broadcast the Maple Leafs to the man who built them, Conn Smythe.
Well, I have to say that to everybody, it's a great loss. He was what you'd call a champion in his field. He was fearless, and his enunciation, his speech was perfect. He was knowledgeable, was kindly, and he was a gentleman. It'll be a great loss. The only thing I can say about it, it's something to set up and the young people to shoot at and trying to emulate what he's done.
Jack's sports association brought him many close personal friendships, like that of the columnist Jim Coleman.
As a friend, I'd like to say that Jack Dennett to me, when I listen to him every morning with that wonderful voice of his, with that warmth and assurance, he always left me with the heartening impression that no matter how bad the news was, listening to Dennett deliver, everything was going to turn out all right.
We reached another friend, Pierre Burton, late today on the Pacific Coast.
Jack Dennett was a first-rate newscaster, a man of considerable integrity, and he bore his last illness with both fortitude and grace. I saw him this summer at a party. He was cheerful. Actually, he was involved in a presentation to me, which an example of some kind of unselfish attitude he had at the time. I think he knew that he didn't have many more weeks to live. He rushed it to completion for that reason. He was a friend of mine. I've known him for many years. I'll always be grateful for having known him, and his passing is, of course, a personal shock.
A close friend in the business world is the dynamic industrialist and uranium mining magnate Stephen Roman.
In my opinion, he was one of the best human beings that I had the privilege of knowing. I considered it a great privilege that I could call him my friend. I considered him very kind and considerate and objective. I feel that Canada lost an extraordinary citizen who was selflessly devoted to the aim of free and prosperous, but mostly a happy Canada.
And in public life, too, there were personal friendships outside politics, like that of Premier William Davis.
It was one of shock and, of course, one of extreme sadness as well. I knew Jack not just in his role in the communications field, but as a personal friend and one who, from time to time, gave me the benefit of his advice and his feelings. And I'll certainly miss him. So will thousands of people across this province. He really, I guess, was something of an institution, if a person can be an institution. And it's very hard to put into words just what one's feelings are at this moment, except of great sadness, a great sense of loss, and losing a friend. And pretty hard to say much more than that, except to say, I think, for all of us, just how much Jack Dennett will be missed.
Jack Dennett's work spoke for itself. he could take the most complex events, translate them into clear and elegant English, for he wrote every word himself, and make the listener think that he was talking to him or her alone. Jack Dennett brought you the news. Despite the fact that he spoke to Canada's largest radio audience, up to 400,000 people each morning, he thought of the so-called radio audience as a collection of individuals.
The space riders aboard Apollo and Soyuz put on quite a show for the global TV audience today. They hailed the start of a new era in the history of man, gave televised tours of their homelands far below, and predicted that international crews will someday fly right off to the planets. The boys are really making themselves at home now, trading visits back and forth in each other's capsules, trying the various dishes prepared for them, some of which I'm sure can't be too appetizing, and doing their best to communicate by using the ground control stations for interpretation.
That was one of the last items from his very last newscast, the 6:30 p.m. that final Friday. All his working days ended at 7 o'clock, unless he was going on to a hockey broadcast. That was 13 hours after they started, at an hour when most people were still in bed. It was a brutal schedule that would have driven most men into retirement by age 59. Jack Dennett insisted on maintaining it, even after his first illness, because, as he said, his audience expected it.
I get down here about 5 after 6 in the morning, and sometimes if there's a good stand-up story, I usually do it the night before. You know, something that you know is not going to change very much. But mostly, I start writing about 20 after 6, and I keep going until the 8 o'clock news.
Jack, do you write easily? Or is it a chore? Is it hard work?
Sometimes I write easily, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I can sit at the typewriter and I can fly through a newscast and bingo, I'm through an hour ahead of time. Just everything just seems to come easy. I think it's how your mind works. Sometimes I'll sit and ponder and get mad get annoyed over why I can't come up with a different angle to a story or a phrase that I'm looking for, but no, I think it changes from time to time. Sinclair writes easy. The easiest man I've ever seen write is Edward R. Murrow. I was posted in London in the 1950 elections, and never have I seen a man turn out so much good copy in such short time. He would turn out 11 pages while I was turning out one, and every bit of it pure nectar.
How long a time do you take trying to select what items you're going to use in the news? You said you came in at about 6.
Well, most of the news is removed from the teletypes by the time I get in here in the morning. And it doesn't take very many minutes to just filter through and see which are the top stories and which ones need the most rewriting and the most consideration. I would say not more than 15 or 20 minutes to sort of scan the news.
Are you a quick read?
Fairly quick, yes. I'm not a Ted Reeve, you know. Ted Reeve can read a page and then close the book and recite word for word what he's read. Amazing man. I can't do that.
I don't think very few, I think very few people could. Do you rehearse what you're going to do when you've done your, when you've written your script? Do you rehearse it?
Never.
Or do you just come in and sit down and do it?
Never. I don't think I've ever rehearsed a newscast in my life. Maybe I should.
I don't think you have any need to. You know, it's pretty hard to improve on perfection, Jack. Are you ever nervous in front of a mic?
I have been, yes. I would much sooner do a broadcast from a studio than a live studio from a live audience broadcast.
Would you?
Yeah. I'm not nervous when I'm with people that I know.
Hard work was a big part of his success. So was desire, as he told Betty Kennedy in that last appearance on CFRB on July the 25th.
When I was 15 years old, I went down and hung around the radio station, made a real nuisance of myself. They gave me a broom, and I swept out the studios, and I put records away, and I picked records, and I did this and that, and ran messages. I remember once when I was getting in their hair. You see, this station I worked for belonged to an automotive outfit called Taylor Pearson and Carson. And, you know, when kids sort of get on your nerves after a while, you send them off on some fantastic journey. And I was sent over to Taylor Pearson and Carson to get a can of antenna grease. Now, antenna grease was supposed to go up and down the antenna to make the radio waves slide off It's easier, you see. No. You know, it's like getting a can of white lampblack and things like that.
Isn't it silly?
But that's how I started, and then I went on the air with my first broadcast on my 16th birthday.
Gee, that's awfully young. I can't
imagine.
Yeah,
so I've been on the air now 43 years, and I guess I'm getting a little long in the tooth.
How many of those years at CFRB?
I was at CFRB came 1943.
Mm. What did you do at CFAC then in Calgary?
My main program at CFAC was just sort of general duty for the first couple of years, and then a chap by the name of Norman Bottrell went out one night, and he got partying a little too much, and he didn't show up for a program called Toast and Marmalade, which was put on by an organization called Jenkins Grosseterias. And they were quite big out there at that time. And Norman didn't show up, so somebody had to do the show, so I did. And that was my introduction. Norman never did get back on that show, and I did 1,662 consecutive broadcasts.
Good heavens.
So I was on there for a long time, over, I guess, about 6 years. Then I went into the Army I did hockey out there, too. And I went into the Army in 1940 with the Calgary Stampeder Hockey Club.
So the Hockey Association really goes a long way back.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And our whole team went in. It was sort of a reserve Army unit, but I got kicked out 5 months later.
It was a medical discharge, the ulcers that were to trouble him most of the rest of his life. The Victory Bond shows with other developing Canadian stars like Lorne Greene followed. Those, the Army experience, and the Lancashire heritage of his parents gave Jack a strong sense of Canadian patriotism, mingled with respect for British institutions and tradition of all kinds. It showed in broadcasts like this one a quarter of a century ago, when, with the late John Collingwood Reid, he described the visit of the then Princess Elizabeth to Toronto.
Before the royal party arrived here at University Avenue Armories today, Regimental Sergeant Major Wigmore put the boys through the stiffest paces we've seen a unit all dressed for a military parade go through in many, many years. The precision of this 48th Highlanders unit, who are standing out here today in their pure white shell jackets and their kilts, is something that I have never seen before, but it's one of those occasions, one of those experiences that it makes it a task to hold your emotions.
On either side of the stairway leading up to the gallery, in the center of which is the royal dais, are guards in the feather bonnets, the red dress feather bonnets. Here's the princess on the gallery, waving to the crowd and the Duke. She's a very neat, trim little figure today. Turning back and smiling at him. Oh, everybody's standing. Now, of course, come the inevitable civic dignitaries, whom she must be good and tired by now.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the Princess Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh have now entered the officers' mess, where they'll take tea. The scarlet-coated mounted policemen are standing outside the door.
The Sergeant Major has now taken over the parade. In a moment, the pipe band will start to play.
From the dignified eyewitness to an occasion of state, Jack Dennett could switch to the role of humorist, as in this surprise 1971 interruption of his colleague in the morning.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jack Dennett. You know, I don't usually have the opportunity of breaking in on Wally Crowder's show because he becomes very disturbed when anybody tries to infuse it with wisdom or entertainment. But this morning I feel impelled to just take a moment of his time to let you know that this is Wally's birthday. When I came in today, I noticed him cowering in the corner, obviously unhappy and looking frightfully deprived and unwanted. It seems he was hurt that we hadn't remembered his special day, and more annoyed when he discovered there wasn't going to be a mass staff turnout to mark the occasion. Wally's a sensitive sort of fellow, you know, and yet he can be very forgiving and pleasant when he realizes that people have dashed off to buy him something to stop his temperamental outbursts and tantrums. Today he's 60, and in surprisingly good shape. He still drinks as much as ever, he still chases girls, he still stays up at night cadging free drinks in the bistros, but we've become very attached to him, and today we want him to know that his birthday is not going to go unnoticed. We're making him a special presentation at noon today, all the IOUs he's carried around for months. If he pays them off, of course, his mind will be greatly relieved, and we'll have the dough to buy him some small gifts. Happy birthday, Wall, you old roustabout, and you're still the only fellow we've known who really let failure go to his head.
The humor could be just as cutting, though not as affectionately aimed, in his news broadcasts.
Ontario's own Don Quixote mounted his charger again today to take on another windmill. Dr. Mort Shulman, the most vocal crusader at Queen's Park, claims he's uncovered new evidence that Metro's drinking water contains dangerous levels of cancer-causing asbestos. However, as far as we know, Dr. Shulman has not turned this evidence over to proper authorities or made details public so that those authorities would have something tangible to work on.
Such sarcasm was, however, not a Dennett habit, and he never attacked people in the news on personal grounds, but rather on issues. He also preferred to boost when he could, rather than knock.
In my life, I've enjoyed the offerings of some of the world's finest zoos. I've seen the famous London Zoo, the Brookfield and the Lincoln Park Zoos in Chicago, considered two of the best, the large zoo in New York, and a couple of others overseas. None are as modern, as complete, or as potentially great as the new zoo we have in Toronto's East End. In creating any such attraction, which has such size and variety, problems are sure to arise, and at the moment our zoo is going through the throes of financial and other agonies. Tomorrow, the executive committee of the board of directors of the Metro Toronto Zoological Society will get together privately to discuss the problems of the new zoo. The development director, Walter Gray, says this meeting will not be open to the public or the media, but it'll be sort of a focal site for a lot of soul-searching and perhaps coming up with solutions. The zoo officials feel another $2 million is needed to make changes in design to ensure the guaranteed health and safety of the animals. Metro Chairman Paul Godfrey has guardedly raised the point that Metro Council may turn down such a request for more funds. He says Metro is simply not a bottomless cookie jar and the lid must be placed on somewhere. The points put forth by both the zoo directors and the Metro Chairman are all valid, but it's hoped some solution can be found because the zoo rates as one of the great pluses in the future in making this one of the continent's greatest and most attractive cities.
One thing we will not be able to do in this tribute to Jack Dennett is to equal the eloquence of the obituary tributes he paid to the great figures on whom he reported in 43 years of broadcasting. This next is the only one he did not write himself, for it came from the typewriter of his much-admired colleague, John Collingwood Reed. But it is the supreme illustration of the Dennett voice in full flight, like a cathedral organ in a hymn of praise to the man he admired above all others in history.
In a little while, all that remains of Winston Churchill, Knight of the Garter, member of the Order of Merit, honorary member of the Royal Academy, statesman, historian, novelist, painter, soldier, the former naval person, as he used to sign himself in his messages to Roosevelt, the man who was not always wrong, as he declared in his famous speech in Fulton, Missouri, will be taken to his last resting place. The mourners, present and absent, will be numbered in the millions. And some will remember that as a very young man, he took time off to sit by the deathbed of his old nanny. We are taking our last farewell to no ordinary man. His country's foes found in him an implacable enemy. Those who were faithful in his country's service found in him a loyal friend. In his personal career, he was modest in victory, undismayed in defeat, and unable to cherish rancor. No man more deserves the encomium attributed by Shakespeare to Antony as he lay on the tomb of Brutus. His life was gentle, and the elements so mixed in him that nature might stand up and say to all the world, "This was a man."
You are listening to a tribute to Jack Dennett on CFRB. Hard work, desire, and a voracious appetite for books on history and politics were all factors in the Dennett success story. The other was that incredible voice, which was a gift.
We had a lady out in Edmonton, used to come down to Calgary and Edmonton to teach the boys, by the name of Bertha Biggs. But it wasn't so much in developing voice as it was in controlling breath. And she was a wonderful old gal. She used to have a... She had a bedpost set on a piece of lead, and she used to have that up in our diaphragm, keeping our diaphragm up while we read, so that we always had our lungs full of air. And that's the only teaching I ever had.
But he developed the voice and his authoritative delivery by reading to his father when his superiors in that first radio job in Calgary in 1932 told him he wasn't good enough. His fluent writing style came much later. The integrity and sense of fair play, respect for authority, and the virtue of hard work he already had from his poor but cheerful, hard-working parents. He had a great respect for his profession.
The media probably has a greater influence on the world public than any newspaper ever had.
Well, it's so personal. It's
yeah, the newspaper is retainable. You can cut it out and store it away. But the media, I'll never forget doing a broadcast following the Kennedy assassination. And in the interim between Kennedy being shot on the Friday, there was that dreadful incident in the bottom of the courthouse where Ruby shot Oswald. And it was a series of events that were very, very disturbing. And yet watching and listening to radio and television that weekend, I've never felt so proud of the profession I've been in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going on the air on the Monday morning and saying that I was never so convinced that freedom in broadcasting and freedom of the press is the... what was the wording? Freedom of the press and freedom in broadcasting is the common means by which the common man gets his common understanding on which he must base his common sense, you know. And the media does all that.
While he had complete editorial freedom in his two daily newscasts, Jack saw his role primarily as that of personal reporter of the news. His own opinions were secondary. But when he thought something needed challenging, he could turn his typewriter and that voice into a persuasive editorial weapon. He did so before the 1974 federal election in this broadcast that was so popular it was repeated the next morning and then made into a record.
The stock markets dipped again today, and while some of the decline here can be attributed to world conditions, such as inflation and high interest rates, part of the blame for our own market slide can be attributed to the fact that not one candidate in the upcoming federal election seems to have the courage anymore to put his name on the line as running on the free enterprise ticket. 40 years ago, this was the proud boast of both the liberals and the conservatives. What's so puzzling is the fact that the name conservative has been retained, but the conservative philosophy has not. The liberals today are further to the left than the NDP was 10 years ago. And sadly, in the view of many, we seem to be slipping into that stage of the welfare state where people eventually say, to hell with working, to hell with saving, let's blow the wad, because we now have the assurance of the government and the politicians that even if the roof falls in, they'll look after us. What many of these short-sighted politicians and political philosophers fail to realize is that without business, large and small as we know it, there will be virtually no taxes earned from corporations. When corporations and small firms don't make money, they don't hire people to work for them. And when people don't have jobs, they don't earn money on which to pay taxes. And when the government doesn't get money from the people, it hasn't any money to keep those who seem so anxious to rely on the state. After traveling across this land for thousands of miles in election campaigns and listening to hundreds of politicians give their story of how they're going to cure all our ills, and after being on the air with 7 Canadian prime ministers, I still think the greatest and most pungent political comment I've ever heard came in those oft-repeated 2 quotes from Sir Winston Churchill years ago, when he said, "Socialism is the philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy." And then he added, the inherent vice of capitalism is the uneven division of blessings, whereas the inherent virtue of socialism is the even division of misery. There's nothing that would please me or the majority of Canadians, I'm sure, more than to see everyone with plenty of money to keep them comfortable and have peace of mind. But this sort of utopia has never been attained in any land in history by trying to tear down wealth in order to prop up poverty. In Russia, things are on a pretty even basis. Everyone struggles with virtually nothing. And sad to say, it's that envious philosophy of bringing everyone down to the level of the lowest that's going to hurt the majority of people in the Western world over coming years. Today, it's almost a crime, or considered so, to be a success. It's not right to be thrifty and astute so that you can save and become secure. There are those who would relieve the successful of their life's rewards to give to those who often, through their own irresponsibility, have not reached the same level. Of course, the ones who should be helped are those who've remained at the bottom of the scale through no fault of their own. There is nothing that will squelch human initiative more than a guarantee that the government will look after you. Just remember, all the promises made by political hopefuls will be paid for with your money and not theirs. It's saddening to think that Canadians place handouts and guarantees of government aid as something honorable. I can remember the day when it was considered something of a shame by those who were proud of their ability to make it on their own. As I've said before, any government which taxes away the rewards of responsible behavior and effort so it can remove the penalties for irresponsible behavior is not something we need or want in Canada. So come on, all you people running for office in Ottawa. Let's take a stand and quit all this vacillation. Let's have a clear division. Let's know your objectives, whether for the system that's kept Canada going for 107 years, which is free enterprise and personal human initiative, or whether it's for socialism and having a government giving all the orders. And don't get social improvements confused with socialistic philosophy, because they're poles apart.
A personal statement of the Dennett philosophy, as well as an illustration of that great talent, just one of many high points in over four decades of broadcasting. He mused about that career in a quieter and final moment on the air.
You know, I've never done anything else but broadcasting since I came out of school. It's the only job I've ever held. If I weren't in this field, I really don't know what I would be in. I don't know what I'd like to be in. But generally, I have been so fortunate with my family and my job. As I told you once before, I think the happiest man in the world is the one who can go to work in the daytime and look forward to going home. And when he's at home, he can look forward to going back to work. And that's the great formula.
Jack Dennett, 1916 to 1975. Broadcaster, newsman, student of history, colleague, friend. This is Torben Wittrup, speaking for everyone at CFRB. All of us are the better for having known and worked with him.